Sunday to run my school. Run a school.
Wow. Okay, so here's the thing. I have said that publicly on the air that I do not want to have kids. But your story is so compelling, I want to have kids and have them go through your... I'm kidding. I get to go through your fifth grade class and then go to your school. Because they'd be better kids for it. And Kenosha, wherever you decide to teach, I can see it now. And those kids are just going to be so much better for it to have you there. Armand Harris, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Until next time, bye everybody. This is WGTD. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to a discussion of local educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Mike Valkovsky, a former KUSD school board member, Sammy Rangel, the life technician and executive director of Life After Hate, Steve Brown, a retired professor of educational leadership, and former Kenosha Unified School superintendent, Joe Manji. Now here's today's Education Matters moderator.
Hello, I'm Karen Sconzard, and this is Education Matters. If you ever applied to or even thought about attending college, one step of that process was sweating through an ACT or SAT exam, which you then submitted along with your grades and recommendation letters, hoping to secure a spot in the freshman class or a big scholarship at the college of your choice. But what if those nerve-wracking tests are not worth the sweat we spent on them? What if standardized test scores don't really tell us anything about who will succeed in college? Today's guest is Dr. Elaine Allensworth, who's going to tell us about her research findings about test scores, in this case, the ACT, which is the test most Wisconsin high school juniors take, versus their high school grade point averages in determining who is more likely to complete college. Dr. Allensworth is the Lewis Sebring Director of the University of Chicago Consortium on Chicago School Research, where she has conducted research on educational policy and practice for the last 20 years. Dr. Allensworth has been the principal investigator on research grants from funders such as the Institute of Education Sciences and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. She has received a number of awards from the American Educational Research Association for outstanding publication, and she holds a PhD in sociology from Michigan State University and was also once a high school Spanish and science teacher. Welcome, Dr. Allensworth.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
So Dr. Allensworth did make a brief appearance on Education Matters back in May 2015 when I interviewed attendees at the annual American Educational Research Association conference that was meeting in Chicago that year. And I sort of asked her some general questions about what was going on in her research in Chicago, and she answered them then. So you can go back and find that in the archives if you want. And also, full disclosure, I worked the Consortium in Chicago School Research back in the 90s through 2001, and we overlapped for a few years at the time, but I wasn't yet a doctor, and she was. So the reason I'm interviewing her today, though, is not because of that. It's because a few weeks ago, I attended an online lecture that she gave based on an article that she published on this topic of test scores versus GPA in high school completion. So can you tell us, Dr. Allensworth, what was the article called? When and where was it published? And what moved you to complete this research?
Sure, yeah. The article was called High School GPAs and ACT Scores as Predictors of College Completion, Examining Assumptions About Consistency Across High Schools. And it was published in Educational Researcher. I did this study because I've been studying, you know, factors that predict educational attainment, high school graduation, and college completion for a number of years now. And I keep finding over and over again that high school GPA is strongly predictive of both high school and college graduation. While test scores, you know, have more modest relationships, and a lot of the relationship really seems to be driven by the fact that students with stronger test scores tend to have stronger grades, stronger GPAs. And it's really students' grades that seem to be the best indicator of students' likelihood of success. But whenever I talk about this research and I talk about the importance of strong grades and you know, implications for school practices and for getting students ready for college, I always get the same question right away. Like the first question people say is, wait, but aren't grades subjective? Right, every single time. Wait, aren't grades subjective? And isn't there grade inflation? It's like people don't want to believe that grades are important because they feel like they're so variable, you can't trust them, right? Well, they'll say, but test scores, you know, it's they're a neutral indicator. And, you know, so we need to look at test scores because they're comparable across schools. So, you know, I decided, you know, well, first of all, I could, you know, this, it's, you know, I get where people are coming from because definitely, you know, there are a lot of factors that will influence students' grades. But at the same time, if they really were variable and unreliable, they would not be predictive. It would be impossible for them to predict later outcomes. And in fact, they're a much stronger predictor than anything else out there. So I started to wonder, well, how unreliable are they? You know, how variable are they actually as indicators of college readiness? And then I also, you know, this assumption that test scores are this neutral indicator also seemed like, you know, a little bit far-fetched to me. You know, people just assume that they're neutral and they have the same meaning across schools, you know, because and students, because I guess everyone takes the same test under the same conditions. But, you know, tests are just a very narrow indicator. You know, they're like test performance is just one thing that matters for success in college, right? And so they could be a neutral indicator of how well students take tests, but it doesn't mean they're necessarily a neutral indicator of how well students are being prepared for college, right? Mm-hmm. And so I thought, well, if we're putting GPAs through these tests about, you know, to find out how consistent GPAs are as indicators of college readiness across high schools, we really should put ACT scores through the same test.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about tests being sort of a neutral indicator, should they be, what it kind of assumes is that the way you get through college is taking tests.
Yes.
That's like the only thing that's going on. And I can assure you that it's not. So I think that's
exactly
right. So, I mean, yeah. We can talk about a little bit more about that. So what is different about your study from past studies on test scores and college completion?
Yeah. Well, first of all, there always is this assumption that test scores have the same meaning. So no one's actually looked to see, you know, is the relationship between test scores and college outcomes the same across high schools? You know, there's just kind of like this assumption. And so people will I've seen people use, you know, analyses that enter test scores and grades in as indicators of college outcomes. And they'll use that information to say things like, oh, this shows that grades are variable, that they have different meaning. And the same model, if you look at it, will actually show that test scores have even worse problems. But yet no one even identifies that because it's not even in people's heads, I think, that test scores actually could, you know, not be, you know, this kind of neutral indicator. So one thing is actually, you know, doing tests to see if tests, you know, putting testing tests, you know, do they actually act as these kind of neutral indicators of college readiness? And then another thing is, you know, people talk about grades being variable and, you know, an A from one school is not the same thing as an A from another school, but they haven't really quantified that. In terms of, you know, what does it mean in terms of readiness for college? And also, they haven't even really kind of dug under that. So they'll say, you know, like an A in one school isn't the same as in another. Well, does that mean like that the relationship between grades and college outcomes depends on what school you went to? So that maybe at some schools, you know, maybe some schools, yeah, they're just giving out grades or they don't have very consistent standards. So there's actually the slope is weak between them, you know, the relationship is mm-hmm. not very strong. Well, maybe at another school, you know, they have really, you know, strong grading standards that are, you know, people follow, and maybe there's a stronger relationship. Is it that the relationship is different, or is it just that there are high school effects that, you know, there are things that are not captured in grades that matter about a high school first whether or not students succeed, so that, you know, students with a B at one high school are more likely to do well in college than students with a B average at another high school, not because of the grades meaning something different, but because there's something about those high schools that matter beyond their grades. And same thing with test scores. You know, you could say, you know, you look at students with a 23 on the ACT, you know, we kind of assume there's this assumption that they are equally prepared for college, but it could mean, you know, there could be lots of things about students' high school experiences that are not captured in that ACT score that actually matter for college graduation. And there could be things that aren't captured in either GPA or ACT that matter for graduation about that high school. So really trying to understand, when people say grades don't have the same meaning, is it that the relationships are different across high based on which high school you go to? Or is it just that there's something about different high schools that matters that's not captured in students, you know, measures of, you know, their individual achievement?
Yeah, and I think that argument about grades being uneven across schools or within a school or whatever, any of those things could be true. But I think one of the things that maybe people are not taking into account is that high school teachers are very much in touch with what's going on at college. A lot of times they're writing letters for their students. They're hearing from them about how well prepared they were or not. Mm-hmm. We often teach AP courses. So to the extent that AP tests are indicative of preparation for college, they have more information about what's going on in college than a lot of people assume that they would, I think. So,
yeah, and I think people, you know, assume that there's just a lot of variation in how teachers grade, mm-hmm. And that there's some easy teachers and hard teachers and easy classes and hard classes. And so, you know, by extension, it means that, you know, grades must have this variable meaning and they mean something very different depending on which school you attend. But actually in another study, you know, I actually looked at the variability based on, you know, what teacher you have, the variability in grades based on what teacher you have, what classes you take, and lots of different factors, you know, who's in the class with you, like, you know, are you in the class with, you know, high achieving peers, low achieving peers. So all those things actually do influence students' grades, but they tend to average out, right? So you might have one teacher that's a harder grader, another teacher that's an easier grader. You're not gonna probably always have the hardest teacher in the grade, right? And you're gonna take so many different classes, which again, it's gonna capture lots of different skills and lots of different expectations. I also find, you know, this idea that there's teachers that are hard teachers, easy teachers, that's true. But there's much more student by teacher differences. So for some students click with one teacher who another teacher or another student really doesn't like. So it's just a lot of variation that as a student, it might seem larger than it actually is. And then it averages out across all your different teachers and classes. Yeah.
Right. Let's walk our listeners through the process of doing this research. So where do you get the test scores in high school GPAs? How many students are we talking about? How do you keep them confidential? Then how do you set it up so you can run these analyses?
Yeah, so we have a data sharing agreement with Chicago Public Schools where we get administrative records from all the students with all of the identifying information scrubbed. So we'll get, you know, each student's ACT score, their grades, you know, for each semester, background information about students, you know, and their school information about their schools for every single student in the school district every single year. Identifying information is scrubbed, so we don't know who the students are, but we can follow them over time and into college to see, you know, so then we can look at students who had particular ACT scores and GPAs when they were in 11th grade, and then look to see, did they enroll in college? Did they graduate from college? And we can look at what colleges they went to using National Student Clearinghouse data.
How many students would that be among like a group, a high school class, like
I need to look at.
Sorry, I'm guessing it's going to be like 20,000 students or something.
Yeah, in each class. Let's see. Right. So if we look at all graduates, we did this in different ways. Some looking at all high school graduates, especially if we're looking at enrollment, and some just looking at students who enrolled in 4-year colleges. Mm-hmm. And so we used a couple cohorts of students. So when looking at enrollment, and we had 55,000 students. When looking at college graduation, we had about 18,000 students.
Right. So just to give you a comparison, listeners, KUSD is about 20,000 students. RUSD is, I think, 16,000 students. So if you kind of game that out, it's less than 2,000 high school graduates a year in KUSD and a little less than that in RUSD. So it's these numbers are big enough to really tell us a story. And then the other thing I would point out is that Chicago Public Schools has an enormous range of school type and school and high school graduates, including consistently some of the highest performing high schools in the entire country, as well as some of the lowest performing. So I think by looking at that data set, it's both large and varied enough that you should be able to get a decent picture. So that's a good reason to do research on it.
Yes, definitely. We're very fortunate.
So then when you set this up, like what kind of analyses did you do? What did you compare? I know that you don't have to explain the exact statistics, but.
Yeah, so we use these hierarchical statistical models where that basically calculate an intercept and a slope for every single high school, looking at the relationship of GPA with college graduation and ACT score with college graduation. So for every single high school in the city, we could see, what is the college graduation rate for students, with a 2.0 GPA, a 2.5 GPA, 3.0, et cetera. So you can see, overall, does the school have strong graduation rates for students at a particular GPA point or ACT score point? And then is the relationship stronger at some schools and weaker at others? First of all, the kind of use that to answer the question, well, does a 3.0 GPA mean something different at one school versus another? And we see, yes, definitely. There are these large differences across high school in college. And I should say, and also, when doing this, we want to adjust for any factors that are not having to do with college readiness. So, test scores and GPAs are related to student background factors such as family economic status, right? And then family economic status is going to influence students' likelihood of completing college, right? But we want to take that out. We want to adjust for student backgrounds because students could succeed in college. What I'm really interested in is academic readiness, right? Are GPAs and ACT scores an indicator of students' likelihood of success, and their academic readiness, not just whether they can afford to pay for college and, living expenses in college and things like that, and not having to work. So first of all, we adjusted each of the lines for the background characteristics of students, including family economic status, so that any kind of benefit from being at a more affluent family is kind of taken out, and vice versa. So we have a number of background factors we control for. Another issue is that ACT scores and GPAs are used for college admissions, and so it could look like ACT scores and GPAs matter, not because they're actually, they indicate a student is more ready than a student with a high GPA or ACT score is more ready than a student with a lower ACT score or GPA, but just because students with stronger qualifications can get into colleges that have more resources, where all students are more likely to graduate, right? And so, we want to look at, are they more ready once they're in? And so we used a couple different methods to, to adjust for that. One of those was simply to control for the characteristics of the colleges that students attended, so that if students attend colleges, you know, where many students tend to graduate, we, you know, we adjusted their rates down to you know, looking at, how are different characteristics of colleges related to graduation, and then adjusted for the fact that all students at some colleges are more likely to graduate than students at other colleges. We also used college fixed effects in another specification. So just different ways of kind of adjusting for that. So we did that, we adjusted for background and college characteristics, you know, where students ended up going to college. And then when we do that, we do see that there are big differences across high school. So students with the same GPA are much more likely to graduate college if they came from one high school versus another high school. And, you know, there are these very large differences. So if you think that GPAs are supposed to capture everything about a student's college readiness, they don't. There are these large high school effects. At the same time, the relationship between students' GPA and college graduation was very consistent across high schools and very, very strong. So no matter where you went to high school, you know, students with higher GPAs were much more likely to graduate than students with lower GPAs who also enrolled in four-year colleges. Right. And that relationship actually was remarkably similar. It was not significantly different across high school. So, you know, even though, yes, teachers, you know, maybe vary in how they give grades, in the end, it all kind of evens out. So the measure of GPA is very consistent across high schools. It's just that there are these high school effects, so that all students from some high schools are more likely to graduate than students from other high schools with the same GPAs, right? The relationship is the same, but the intercept is different. If you think about intercept and slopes, right? So there are these high school effects that are just not captured by GPAs. So then we looked at ACT scores, and again, so the same kind of thing. Students with the exact same ACT score are more likely to graduate if they come from one high school than if they come from another high school. Again, there's just these high school effects that exist that are not captured in students' individual measures of achievement, their individual ACT scores. Unlike the relationship with GPAs, though, the relationship between ACT scores and college graduation depended on which high school you attended, right? So at some high schools, there was pretty much no relationship between ACT scores and whether or not students would graduate. So students from the same high school were not more likely to graduate. The students with higher test scores were not more likely to graduate than students with lower test scores from the same high school. And then at some high schools, there was a relationship. At all high schools, the relationship was much, much weaker than the relationship between GPAs and college graduation.
Wow. So the bottom line is, it does matter which high school you go to, and we'll explore that a little bit, but not so much. It's more about your GPA than it is about your test score, for sure. That is consistent across schools.
Yeah. So it all, no matter where you go to high school, getting higher grades means you're more likely to graduate college.
Okay.
But, you know, getting higher ACT scores, not necessarily.
So let me just do a quick reintroduction. You're listening to WGTD HDFM. I'm your host, Karen Sconzert, and this is Education Matters. This discussion of research on ACT scores, high school grades, and college completion with Dr. Elaine Allensworth is archived at WGTD.org on the Education Matters page. You are invited to listen again, or you can find our WGTD Education Matters Facebook page and join in a discussion there. So we've talked about sort of what you did. In the lecture that I saw you gave, you talked about the metaphor of a high school football coach choosing a team. And I think that's a really good way for our audience to understand this. So tell us about that.
Yeah, well, so people are always saying to me, well, how can GPAs be variable, you know, and based on, you know, and, you know, be influenced by all these different conditions and teachers, and yet still be so predictive, while test scores, you know, are very, you know, uniform, reliable, and, you know, be weaker. And so I always say, I've been saying, well, you know, think about if you're a coach for a football team and you're choosing your players, are you going to, how much are you going to base your decisions about who's going to be on your team based on how fast they can run 100 meters, right? 100, you know, you can measure a student's, you know, running speed pretty much in the same way at all schools across all contexts. Other indicators of a performance, you know, like points scored, you know, passing, you know, sportsmanship, all those kinds of things, they're going to depend on, well, who are you playing and who are your teammates and, you know, the conditions of the field and all, you know, the crowd, all these other kinds of things. So, you know, those are all variable, those are subjective, right? Are you going to ignore all of those and just really focus mostly on how fast the student can run 100 meters? If you did that, you know, you're probably, you know, not going to recognize students who are really talented, you know, and would be great football players. And you're also, you know, if you focus just so much on, you know, can students run 100 meters and you use that as your indicator of, you know, of quality of student readiness to perform, I just think you're going to spend all your time, students are going to spend all their time training in terms of just running. They're actually not going to be developing as, you know, as really good players who can do all the other kinds of skills that are needed for the team. And so you're actually going to end up, you know, with a less prepared players and a lower quality team by focusing on this one, you know, indicator that is, you know, consistent and not subjective.
Right. So, and I think a lot of colleges have actually gotten the message on this. So the college where I teach, Carthage College, the place where you work, University of Chicago, they've dropped the requirement of a standardized test score for admission. So, you know, I just recently heard a radio documentary about this, about how the pandemic has meant that many kids do not have this score because mm-hmm. they would have taken it last spring when the schools were completely shut down. So Illinois, for instance, has required the SAT of 11th graders for a few years. They switched from ACT to SAT. But since they were locked down last spring, it was waived for the students who are graduating this year. So 2021 graduates don't even have an ACT score to submit. I mean, do you know, has your research at all influenced the colleges in what they should focus on, or is it more other factors?
Yeah. Well, I think it's probably made people feel, you know, less worried, less concerned about the fact that they don't have test scores. I have had a number of people ask about that. Mm-hmm. Ask about that. I think a lot of, you know, colleges do their own institutional research. And I think one reason there has been this movement towards, you know, test score optional admissions is because colleges recognize that test scores don't tell them a lot about who's going to succeed anyway. I think there's a lot of outside pressure for colleges to put attention on test scores and admissions because they get ranked based on average ACT and average SAT scores. So it would be very hard for them, you know, to kind of give up that attention, and because it could affect their ratings. But the fact is, you know, I think many colleges have long recognized that test scores are very limited in what they can say about students.
I kind of think like the whole reason that these particular two tests, ACT and SAT, have become more common. So, you know, back in my high school years, the only people who took these tests were people who were planning to go to college. Mm-hmm. But now they're just sort of like the test everybody takes their junior year. So there, mm-hmm. so you have to assume that the SAT and ACT companies are really putting the pressure on, or they have managed to convince state boards of education or state legislators to do this, because you could go back to some other test or no test at all, really. But yeah. The fact that they're using these is, you know, is an interesting choice.
Well, it's because of the movement towards test-based accountability in education that, you know,
Right, but they could use a different test, like a state-based test like they do in the lower grades. They wouldn't have
to. But then why make students take two different tests? You know, it's very consistent. You know, a lot of states, you know, especially with Common Core state standards, but even before then, a lot of states have now, you know, come out and said, you know, our mission is to prepare students for college and career. And so they adopt the SAT or the ACT as their state tests in the high schools. Because it's consistent with their goals for students, because, you know, it's the exam you need to, you know, you used to need to take at least to apply to college. And so that way all students have scores. And so, you know, it eases the burden on students. You don't have to pay for the test yourself. And it makes sure that that's one barrier that could be removed for students to applying for college. I think it makes a lot of sense from, you know, if you're thinking about what are the goals for students, and as long as those tests are used in college admissions. One problem comes, though, in that, you know, the tests really kind of frame their score reporting around, you know, these college benchmarks, and the messaging that you get from the tests is that they are good indicators of how well students, you know, will succeed. So they have, you know, both the SAT and ACT, they have these college benchmarks. They say if you get a score that's at or above these benchmark scores, then you have a 75% chance of getting a C or better in a college class. And they, you know, this message you get all the time. And so the interpretation that people have is, oh, if you meet these benchmarks, you're ready for college. If you don't meet the benchmark, you're not ready for college. And unfortunately, students get these messages like, oh, not there yet. You know, you need to work harder and maybe you'll be ready for college. The problem is, you know, and then people get really nervous because if you look, only like 25% of test takers actually do meet all of the benchmarks on either the ACT or the SAT. So, you know, it looks like 75% of students are failing to be ready for college at the end of their junior year. And that's very distressing. And so then people say, our schools are not doing, you know, a good job, and students are getting these messages, you may not be ready. However, the tests actually aren't that predictive. You know, so they say, oh, that's the point where you have a 75% chance of succeeding. They don't say what your chance of succeeding, of getting a C or better is if you don't meet the benchmark. There's this, I think people look at that and they say, oh, your chances, you know, if you're not meeting the benchmark, your chance is close to zero. It's not, you know, they don't actually put out the data that tell you what your chances are at any score other than the benchmark score. And so your chance might be 74%, right? Or 70%. Mm-hmm. And in fact, ACT actually does put out their benchmark data. SAT does not, College Board does not. And, you know, looking at their data, you know, for a typical student, their probability probably is around the typical student who is not meeting the benchmark on the, you know, for every test but math, their probability of success is probably around 70% instead of 75%, right? So it's not 75%, but it's not necessarily that much lower. You know, they're trying to, you know, they really want to have a test that's going to show how students are ready for college, but the test really can't show that. And so then the messaging ends up being confusing to people and potentially really misleading in a way that could undermine students' confidence in their skills when they go to college, and could, undermine trust in our schools.
Right. Or it might make people think they have to take the tests more than once, and then the second and third time they have to pay for them. Mm-hmm. And so I know that these two companies that make these tests are supposed to be nonprofit, but there's probably good reason for them to encourage people to take the tests more than once. So it's a little hard to, hard to take them as a neutral party.
Of course they believe in their product, and so they, you know, they want to put out information that's going to make sure other people have confidence in, you know, in their product. You know, where it completely makes sense. as long as you're, you know, from one perspective in terms of thinking about we want to, you know, if the goal is to have a test that will be an indicator for college, you know, for college success, but then you have to ask the question, which does not get asked, how strong is it as an indicator? And does it remain a strong indicator once you control for student background, college characteristics, high school effects? And unfortunately, a lot of the, you know, the validation studies that are out there don't control for all of those things. They certainly don't control for high school effects. They do things like they'll look at how much more a test score predicts college success above and beyond students' self-reported GPAs. And they'll say, oh, look, test scores, you know, explain a little bit more of whether or not students will have success or give a slightly better prediction. Problem is students' self-reported GPAs are not as accurate as their actual GPAs.
And right. So, yeah. That was another thing I thought was unique about your research is that people were just taking student reported GPAs, what they guessed their GPA was.
Yeah.
A lot of schools have weighted GPAs. So students really don't have a sense of what their actual GPA is. So
yeah,
they're overestimating their own or underestimating what there is. So
yeah, well, and that's another thing. People a lot of times will use weighted GPAs and say, weighted GPAs are not as predictive as unweighted GPAs. You know, people I think, oh, but they incorporate, you know, how hard the classes were. But it's really confounding what classes students took, which is a kind of weaker predictor of how well students were in college with how well they did in the classes they took, which the really strong predictor is. And also the weights that are used are not equivalent to how much harder it is to get a good grade in like an honors class or an AP class.
Yeah.
You know, it's that you get, I think, an extra 2 points for an AP class, but it's, I forget exactly. I calculated how much harder it is to get like a high grade, and it's like a half of a GPA point, you know.
But you get rewarded more for.
But you get rewarded 2 points, so it really distorts the metric.
So we have one kind of really good, maybe a natural experiment in this, or something, and that is since 1997, the University of Texas at Austin changed their policy. So that's their flagship university. It's the equivalent of University of Wisconsin-Madison or University of Illinois at Urbana. It's their flagship state university. They have several other excellent state universities, but this is the one that sort of the hardest to get into and the biggest and all that. They began to admit any student in the state of Texas who was in the top 10% of their high school class based on GPA only. And in the end, I mean, like at first everybody objected and the professors were like, no, we can't teach these other kids. Some high schools are better than others, blah, blah, blah. But it's actually turned out to be a pretty solid move. Like people who got into Austin actually do pretty well if they make it past their first semester freshman year. That's always the tricky part. And it is for a lot of people in any college. So does this connect at all with the research you've done on test scores and GPAs?
Yeah, definitely. You know, obviously, as they're saying, GPA is a much stronger predictor of success than test scores. And so even if you weight them equally and say, oh, we're going to count test scores and GPA the same, you will probably not be making as good of a prediction of student success as if you just look at GPAs. And then beyond that, test scores do serve as a barrier for a lot of students. So both test scores and GPAs are related to background characteristics like family economic status. So I'm not saying GPAs are in any way perfect, and there are definitely equity concerns, you know, in terms of, you know, how easy or hard it is to get to have a high ACT score and a high GPA, because the more that a family has resources to invest in things like tutoring or even just transportation to get to school every day, quiet spaces to get homework done, you know, all those things matter for grades. And then of course with tests, you know, you can take the test multiple times, you can pay for tutors to help with, you know, prepare for, you know, there are factors with, you know, there are equity issues that we really need to consider with both of those indicators. But with test scores, it actually is worse. Because first of all, because it's just, you know, they're just taken once. You know, if you have a lot of resources, you know, some families are pouring an immense amount of resources into getting students higher scores. And, you know, we saw it kind of went to the crazy end with the, you know, the Varsity Blues scandal and everything, where people got paid to take tests for others. And, but because it's only, you know, you only need to do well that one time or the one day, you can manipulate it more. You know, they're like ways to cheat, you know, basically. But beyond that, you know, people have this idea that, you know, if you work hard, you know, you're going to have these big improvements in test scores. We don't actually see that. Test scores are really pretty stable. So, you know, students can be working really hard. They can show, you know, higher than average gains, but the differences that exist among students when they start school are something like 8 grade levels, I mean, worth of learning. Like, they're very, very large. A student that starts at like the, you know, the 10th percentile, let's say in third grade, even if they make 95th percentile gains, they're not going to end up higher than the 20th percentile at the end of eighth grade, just because the amount that students grow on tests from year to year is very small relative to the differences that exist between them. And those differences are associated with family economic background, right? And so, you know, it's going to be hard to actually make the kind of gains that you would need to have a competitive score if you're starting out without a high score. And people may say, oh no, that's terrible. That means students aren't learning, whatever. It's not true. Like I just said before, is test scores are not strong indicators of how you're going to do in college. There are all these skills that matter beyond just test performance, right? Mm-hmm. So even if students don't have very high scores, they're still learning and growing in school. They might not end up with the high test scores, but they still could be very, very well prepared for college and likely to succeed, right? And so if we're relying just on the tests, then you know, there are going to be some students who are never going to be able to make those scores, even if they're like working really hard, learning a lot, and they have lots of other strengths. So it's, you know, it's just not very malleable in terms of like something you can do something about, but it doesn't matter because it's not that predictive.
It's not that helpful. Right?
Yeah. And then beyond that, you know, the focus on the tests has really destructive. It does, when you focus so strongly on the tests, you end up having people engage in practices that are actually problematic for student learning and growth and development. So if there's so much focus on the test, then students are going to spend a lot of time just learning test-taking skills and just taking practice tests. That is, first of all, it's boring. It doesn't actually, you know, there's no learning associated. You don't develop, you know, cognitive frameworks or, you know, learn how to do things in real life. There's no actual anything to be gained from that except being more familiar with the test, right? And so students end up spending a lot of time that's, it's not a good use of time for learning. It's incredibly boring. And then schools, because they feel like they've got to give students every chance of success, they'll end up not doing, you know, instruction that is really good for students and having students develop all those different skills and knowledge. They end up narrowing their curriculum just down to tested subjects, you know, math and English language arts, and then teaching in ways that are similar to the kinds of questions asked on tests. When actually what's good for students is to be doing, you know, analysis and application and writing and speaking and learning, you know, about lots of different subjects. And, you know, and applying math and reading and, you know, in different ways, right? Not just studying them for the sake of studying them, right? And so it ends up corrupting education in ways that are bad for students and, you know, defeat, you know, motivation and actual, you know, development of broader skills that students need.
Right. We're actually out of time. You've been listening to WGTD HDFM. This is Education Matters, and this discussion of research on ACT scores, high school grades, and college completion with Dr. Elaine Allensworth is archived at WGTD.org on the Education Matters page. I will post the link to the article and to the other research from Dr. Ellensworth on our Facebook page, so you can access it there. Thank you very much for your time. This was great.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard each Saturday morning at 10:30 on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Archive programs are available on our website, WGTD.